You're listening to The Murder in My Family, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including Missing Persons,
DNA ID,
Scene of the Crime,
Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
Citizen Detective,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
The views and opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the podcast, its host, or sponsors.
If you would like to discuss the murder in your family on this podcast, please be sure to visit themurderinmyfamily.com for more information. This episode may contain unsettling material or subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Murder in My Family. I'm your host, Mike Morford.
In this episode, we'll be discussing the case of a young father who is looking towards the future and hoped to become a police officer. Instead, he died from a gunshot that investigators said was self-inflicted, something his mom strongly disagrees with, or at the very least, questions.
We'll dive into this case after some quick housekeeping. Independent podcasts like this one depend on word of mouth to bring in new listeners. So if you find that you enjoy this show, please take a moment to rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcast. And be sure to introduce a friend to the show and invite them to listen. With your help, The Murder of My Family can continue to grow and reach a new audience. To learn more about the show or the cases we discuss, please visit themurderofmyfamily.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @murderofmyfam or on Facebook at facebook.com/TMIMFpodcast.
If you'd like to support The Murder of My Family and get VIP access to things like ad-free listening, early preview episodes, and bonus content of not only this show, but for every other podcast on the Abject Network of Indie Podcast, consider subscribing to the show with an Abject Insider subscription through Apple Podcast. For only $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year, you'll unlock a variety of listener benefits, and you'll be supporting the show in the process. Your support is greatly appreciated.
And thank you to all of the supporters that generously donate to help keep the show growing and improving. One last note. Please support any of the sponsors that you hear on The Murder of My Family, the way that those sponsors support the show. It's with our sponsor support that this show can go on and continue to provide a platform to share these stories with you in every episode. Thank you. And now on with the show.
The empty seat at the otherwise joyous table. Many of us have one. These empty chairs, each one representing the loss of a loved one, always seem larger at this time of year, during the holiday season. Somehow even more empty. A reflection of the magnitude of what is truly missing from the holiday. Many of us are polishing off the last of our Thanksgiving leftovers and preparing for Christmas, where we'll be faced with the lack of those special loved ones once again. For Jamie Flight, 7 holiday seasons without her son has not made it any easier to bear the pain of his absence. This episode's a bit different than any other episode of the podcast that I've done before, in that the victim, Zachary Flight, hasn't been ruled homicide victim, but rather a suicide victim, something his mom, Jamie, strongly disagrees with. She feels that there was a rush to a conclusion, and there's more to the story than meets the eye. Could Jamie be on to something, or is she just a grieving mother unable to accept the truth in her son's death? I'll leave it to listeners to form their own opinions. One thing's for sure. Through her grief, Jamie has remained focused on the hope that one day there will be answers as to what really happened to her son, Zachary James Flight. I want to point out and make it abundantly clear that no one has been charged with any crimes connected to Zachary's death, and anyone mentioned in this episode is considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Zachary Flight, or Zach as he went by, was born on April 8, 1995 in Tucson, Arizona. Zach was an adventurous boy who was always on the go and was into skateboarding, and he taught his little sister to skateboard too, and he was very close with her. But one thing Zach wasn't into was school. It just wasn't for him, and when his teens, he quit school. But he knew that the lack of a diploma might hold him back, so he got his GED. As a young man, Zach was like many people. He didn't know what he wanted to do with his life, but eventually he thought he might want to become a police officer. In August 2005, Zach had his first child, Sammy. Soon, two more children, Logan and Riley, followed. Zach was a proud young father of three, but like many, he was also worried about how he would financially provide for his family in the long term. He knew that he needed something in his life that would help plot the course for him as an adult to stably provide for his children. On January 5th, 2017, Zach received a call that was going to change the course of his future. His application to take the police academy exam had been accepted, and he was scheduled to take the test on January 20th. By all accounts, Zach was excited for the opportunity, but sadly, he didn't live to see that day. Just 3 days after learning that he was going to be taking the exam and potentially joining the academy, Zach and his girlfriend, Dominique, visited her parents. The two had been dating for about 3 months at the time. This day changed Jamie Flate's world. She answered a call from a number she didn't recognize and found herself speaking to a police officer from the Pima County Sheriff's Department. She learned that Zach was in the hospital and it was an emergency situation. He wasn't sick and he hadn't been in a car accident. Instead, Zach had a gunshot wound to his head. Despite having been shot just 10 minutes from the hospital, Zach didn't get to the emergency room for over an hour after the shooting. It will never be known whether that time could have saved his life, but it's a question that nags at Jamie to this day. Zach's condition left Jamie with an impossible decision to make. Should she wait and keep him hooked up to life support, even though all the medical professionals were telling her time wouldn't help him recover? Or should she allow him to help other people via organ donation, even if it meant that she would lose her son forever? Zach, who always put others before himself, was a proud organ donor. It was his wish that he could help a few strangers just one last time after his death. Jamie wrote on UNOS.org, an organ donor site, "As hard as it was, I made sure that his wish was carried out. Zach was able to donate his heart, liver, lungs, kidneys, corneas, and tissue to help other people." At the hospital, doctors found a scalp laceration and a bump on Zach's head. His mom believes that these injuries may be proof that he was in some sort of physical altercation before he was shot. Jamie has heard different versions of what happened right before Zach was shot. In each version, Zach was supposedly upset over a text that Dominique received and wanted to break up with her. The sender of the text and the subject matter reportedly changed in different tellings. Whatever was said as Dominique tried to stop him from leaving her house that day and ending the relationship is unknown, but according to her, Zach was so upset he turned the gun on himself and pulled the trigger. Police seemed quick to agree on a suicide, but unanswered questions nagged at Jamie. She's never heard the 911 call or seen any crime scene photos. Zach's phone is missing, and it was never returned to his family. He was known to have his phone with him at all times, and when he was shot, it was apparently charging in a bathroom, but it never made it to the hospital with him. It was Dominique who called 911 that day, telling the dispatcher that Zach shot himself. As far as Jamie knows, the investigators who responded to the scene took Dominique's word and did no further investigation. No gunshot residue tests were performed on either Zach or Dominique. The lack of transparency and access to official case information about her son's death, coupled with an apparent connection between Dominique's family and the Pima County Sheriff, make it hard for Jamie not to feel like the truth has been purposely hidden from her. I know that it's common for many of the families and friends of people who have taken their own lives to struggle with accepting that truth, but there does seem to be a few inconsistencies here. To Jamie, Zach seemed happy. He loved her and his sister and his kids. He was excited about the police academy. If he was hiding a dark state of mind from her, or pretending to be excited about the police academy exam, due to his missing phone, she can't go in it and see if he was really telling friends he was looking forward to it, or if his tone seemed depressed in his final messages. Could he have been hiding a side from her that she's not aware of? She'll never know without that phone, and it's unclear to this day what happened to the phone. Until she knows that an investigation of some sort did happen, Jamie continues to feel that justice has been stolen from her son Zach. Hearing the 911 call and seeing the crime scene photos would help Jamie understand what truly happened, either way. While it may be difficult to see and hear those things, Jamie's prepared to face it, if police would just let her have access to it. Jamie's just a mother looking for answers in the untimely death of her son, meeting one roadblock after another. The truth, whatever it is, will never take away the pain that Zach's loss has caused her, but Jamie believes that the truth will allow Zach's soul to rest in peace, and for her to have some peace. Until then, she'll continue to fight for the justice she believes her son deserves. If you or someone you care about is struggling with thoughts of suicide, there is help. Call 988 or visit 988lifeline.org. I sat down with Jamie to discuss her son's untimely and tragic death and her efforts to find out what exactly happened. That conversation is coming up in just a moment. Hi, Jamie. Thank you for coming on the Murder My Family to discuss your son Zach's case.
Thank you for having me.
I'm happy to have you here and hear about Zach's story. There's a lot of things that it seems like you've had to deal with in the case, a lot of answers that maybe were given that you don't agree to or don't line up with the facts. And I want to get into all of that, what happened and where things stand today and what you learned along the way. Before we do, can you tell us a little bit about your son, Zach, and what was going on in his life leading up to this tragedy?
Well, Zach was definitely interesting, and he liked to keep life at his hand. He was always an energetic, outgoing kid. I turned 18, and then I had him. Okay, let me back up. I'm sorry. January 31st, I turned 18, and then I had him April 8th of 95. And so I raised him, and he was into skateboarding, and he was skateboarding since he was 5 years old, and that's how he dealt with frustration and whatever. And we're in Arizona, and every skate park in Arizona knows who my son is. And then he actually started teaching kids how to skateboard. And then I had my daughter 7 years later, and she was a skateboarder. And so that's what he did. That was his passion. And at the time, he liked to keep life interesting. He got two sisters pregnant. So now he's got three babies between two sisters. And at around December, he met this girl. He was selling clone out of the trunk of somebody else's car. And if his mouth was moving, it was crap. I mean, he could sell you the sun and you would have bought it, not knowing why you bought it, but you did because he convinced you to do it. So this girl had pulled up and he's all flirting with her and stuff. And she claims that she was getting her nursing degree or whatnot. He's like, oh, well, I'm getting my doctorate degree. And she believed him. And so they started dating for about 2 months. And they were in my kitchen. And he found out she was talking to her ex. So he was ending it with her. She was bawling hysterically, saying she couldn't live without him. He was her life and all this other stuff. Well, the following week, I had found out she was having an outpatient procedure at the hospital, and her parents live in Pima County in Tucson. And I asked him, I said, is anybody going to be there with her? Because I've had many surgeries and it's scary going in. He's like, no, nobody wants to be around her. And I said, well, do me a favor, just be there for support in the lobby. When she's done, take her to her parents and then wash her hands of her. Said, Mom, do I have to? And the one time he listened to me in 21 years, he goes to take her to her parents' house and his truck breaks down. And next thing I know, I get a call that he's in the hospital with the gunshot wound to his head.
So that's so really out of the blue, not something you're expecting.
Correct.
I want to go back to some of the details surrounding that. You find this out, obviously. This is a terrible thing to find out. You're probably shocked by it. What were you told happened, and what did you, what were your first thoughts?
Let me back up a little bit, just with that week coming up. January 5th, he found out, because he was trying to find a job where he could support his babies. And on January 5th, he found out he was going to be able to take the exam for the police academy because he wanted to become a cop. So he was scheduled for January 20th. And I was actually scheduled for a major surgery. I was rear-ended back in 05. I've had two surgeries where they've had to put plates in my neck and then the plates broke. So it took me 4 years to be nicotine free. I was good to go. And then I was scheduled for January 13th. Well, then I started freaking out because it's Friday the 13th. And all my surgeries have always been on a Monday. And I started freaking out because I'm like, why Friday the 13th? And my son and daughter are like, Mom, you're being ridiculous. You know, we'll be there. And I said, yeah, tell Freddie and Jason that when I'm under the knife, you know, on Friday the 13th. So there was nothing of depression. It was all excitement of everything that he was starting to put into place. And so the day that we got the call, it was like honestly, I don't even remember what time. It was in the middle of the night. And my daughter woke me up and she said, Mom, Zach's in the hospital. We have to get there. And that's all we knew is he was in the hospital with a gunshot wound to his head. So we get in the car. I don't even remember who drove or whatever. I didn't even realize because we live in Phoenix, but this happened in Tucson and I didn't realize we were in Tucson until like later that night. And when we got to the hospital, they said, we're sorry. He was an organ donor. So they had him on the ventilator, but there was no brain function, whatnot. They were just keeping him on the ventilator for the donation, I guess. But that was on the 8th, and on the 9th at 10 in the morning, they came in and took him off to see if there was any brain function, and there wasn't. And so then they finalized it January 9th, 2017 at 10 a.m. in the morning. And so what I knew he had a gun because I hate guns. I've always hated them and I never wanted them in my house. And my son was like, Mom, go to a gun safety class with me and you'll feel more comfortable. And I said, no, I am not going to feel comfortable until that gun's off your hip and out of this house. Oh, you're being ridiculous. That's crazy out there. And I'm like, no, when you're looking for it, you're going to find it. And so one of the baby's mamas, Heather, was living with us. And they had told me that Dominique, which was the girl that he was taking to her parents' house, had bought him the gun and this truck. But when we were heading back home later that day, Heather had said, I'm so sorry, but we got Zach the gun. But I didn't want you mad at us and so forth. And so anyways, that's where it went is they said it was a suicide. And there was two things I wanted. I wanted his cell phone because of the pictures of the babies and whatnot. And I wanted the bullet because the bullet never exited. Well, I got the bullet, but I never got the phone. And her story, Dominique's story, kept changing. And it was this one day. It was that the next day. So I kept asking her, I said, well, can you ask your parents to find it? Because she said, well, maybe it got lost in my parents' house. And then her story kept changing, saying, oh, well, the cops came back the next day to get it and so forth. So I requested the police report because I figured, well, the police report should tell me where his cell phone is. And so that's where we stood. That's how this all started. Was trying to find his cell phone.
So this happened at their house?
At her parents' house, yes.
Okay. And according to her, was she there when it happened?
Yeah.
And what did she say happened?
It was her and him. Okay, that's where the story gets crazy because she blocked me on everything after this. And when I got the police report, one and one was not equaling two. And my son has tons of friends and they all call me Mom, but he had two best friends that he grew up with And one of their moms, her name's Danielle, and she always called my son a son from another mother. So her and I have been with this from day one, and she's still with me on this. And when we got the police report, I started reading it. In one paragraph, she said that she got a text in the middle of the night from her pastor asking how the procedure went. And she said, we were drinking. Zach saw the text and flipped out, grabbed the gun and killed himself. But in another text, she said he had the gun aimed at me and I was so scared because he was going to kill me. And then a few paragraphs down, she said he tried to leave, but I wouldn't let him because it was like midnight. And then the parent's story is he came in, he didn't have any signs of depression or anything. He seemed to be in a good mood. And then a few paragraphs down, it said, well, he was depressed because he lost his business. His truck broke down. He doesn't have any money. And it's like, well, which is it? You know, I mean, was he aiming the gun at you when you were trying to leave? If that was the case, I wouldn't care what time it was. I would let him leave, kick him out, you know. But then she says that he had the gun aimed at her, but she wouldn't let him leave because it was like midnight. And then also we were checking timelines and they live 10 minutes away from the hospital. I know where her parents live and I know where the hospital is because it turned out I had him at the same hospital he died at. Because I had him in Tucson and then we moved to Phoenix when he was 2.5, but he ended up dying at the same hospital I had him at. So it's 10 minutes away, but it took 2.5 hours to get him to the hospital. Why? I don't know. But it states in the police report, as I was getting down, there's only one mention of his cell phone, and it was connected to a charger in the bathroom. And that's how the cops got my number, was out of his phone. But then there's no more mention of it. And so I was like, this is kind of weird. And then at the end of the police report, the mom calls up the sheriff's department demanding that they remove my son's belongings. And the deputy said, well, that's not our responsibility. What we can do is contact the next of kin and they can come remove his belongings and we can be there just so there's no issues. And quote unquote, in the police report, she states, that answer is unacceptable. We don't want our daughter to have anything to do with that part of the family that caused our daughter to be traumatized. And they said, we're going to call Sheriff Napier because he'll get this taken care of. And hung up on the deputies, I guess. And then the dad calls up and yelling and demanding. So that's how I found out that they're friends with the sheriff, because she states it in the police report. And then after I started requesting, because there was never an investigation, it was labeled as a suicide and that's it. So I got on this website, avvo.com, and it's where you can get on this site and you can ask anonymous questions and attorneys will give you their opinions. And that's all it is. And so I heard about it. I got on it and I said, okay, if there's two people in the room, one dies of a gunshot wound to the head, what's the next step? And there's about 6 or 7 of them that all said they rule out homicide before they determine suicide. They do the blood splatter. They check the gun residue. They make sure they interview everybody and they make sure that there's no doubt that it was a homicide and before they label suicide. Well, that never happened in my son's case. She said it was a suicide and that was it. When I asked the sheriff's department, the sergeant, I asked, so did you guys test the gun residue? He told me, no, that's only done in the movies. And I was like, okay. And then Dominique, when I had mentioned to her about the phone again, she said, well, they came and got it the next day. So I asked the sergeant, I said, did you guys go back and get my son's phone the next day? And he said, no. We would never go back and do that. And she said, after it was like phone tag, kind of like, she said, Well, yeah, they did, because they called me to get the code to get into it, which is another lie because of the fact that he didn't have a code on it, because that's how they got my number to begin with. And so the sergeant said, well, keep on with Dominique and I'll have somebody else try to see if they can locate your son's phone. And I said, okay. So that's where it went. That's the beginning of it.
So it sounds like right away there was a rush to judgment that this is a suicide. No other steps were taken. When it went to a medical examiner, did he back up the story, or did it go to medical examiner? But if so, did they back up the story of being suicide?
Well, that's another crazy part, is the medical examiner, before they received his body, they had contacted me, and his name is Christopher, and he had said, we're waiting to receive his body, and I just want to kind of get an idea of what's going on. And so I had told him my concerns, and there was text messages between one of his baby's mamas and Dominique, because they were kind of like friends and hung out. And her name's Melissa, and she was contacting Dominique just to get an idea of what happened. And so I have their text messages between both of them, make copies of them and all that. We created a binder, me and Danielle did, and it's from point A to Z and everything in between. And I did that along with my statement letter, because it's just easier to send out my statement letter. And so she had a copy of all their text messages and whatnot. And where was I going? Oh, in the medical examiner's office, we had contacted them, and they said normally they would send out their own investigative team, but the sheriff's department said there was nothing to investigate, and it was suicide, and that was it. And so the first year, I wasn't associating it with myself, and I do a lot of research. If something doesn't make sense to me, I'll keep researching it until I figure it out. And like the first year, I was finding all this stuff and it wasn't making sense to me, but it was almost like I was associating it with me helping a friend that lost her kid, not me personally. And I was looking up all, I requested everything that had to do with my son's case. And they sent me another police report. They sent me the medical examiner's report, and just oddball things. Like they gave me the 911 calls of the parents calling the sheriff's department and so forth. But I never got the actual 911 call of that night. Then they kept sending me pictures of the gun, which was completely wiped clean, which didn't make sense to me, because if he killed himself, it should have blood and guts all over it. But it was completely clean. And of the truck, they never sent me pictures of the actual room where he was shot at. And so I kept making requests. Now, January will be 7 years. And so then I ended up trying to figure out, like, what do I need to do to get the whole picture? Because I said, I want the actual 911 call of the night, and I want the actual picture of the bedroom. And I wasn't getting it. So we had contacted the medical examiner. I hired a private investigator, and we did a GoFundMe, got them the money, and they had contacted the medical examiner's office, and they said, you know what? We really can't tell one way or another, because normally we would send out our own team, but they said there was nothing to investigate. And so that's what they went with, is putting it for suicide. And there's a POMC group, Parents of Murder Children. I was going to a mental doctor, and she had found information for this group. And she said they have a second opinion group where there's volunteers that are throughout the states and stuff, but you can send them your information. And then the second opinion, it's like attorneys, lawyers, doctors, judges, whatever. They'll look, they'll send that part of your case to them. That's what they do. They give you a second opinion. They can't act on it, but they can recommend what to do. So that's why me and Danielle made the binders, was to send it to the second opinion group. And so that's where we ended up being at that point. And so then the second year, I still wasn't getting anything, but it started the reality was starting to hit that the things I was looking at was my son. And the hospital report said that because of the timing to get him there, it was past the golden hour to save it. They couldn't save him. And in this Parents Murdered Children group, there's a lady, her name's Denise. Her son was murdered, but she had medical examiner background. She had doctor background. And she was looking over the police report and the medical examiner's report. And she said, there's no way he could have shot himself because of the position of the bullet. And pretty much everything was just people's thoughts, you know, their opinions. There hasn't been anything definitely. But so her thought was, is that he was sleeping and then they killed him by the where the gunshot was. My gut's always been, I feel like Dominique did it. She had the gun and he was threatening to leave. And I felt like she accidentally, I don't think she meant to do it on purpose. That's always been my gut feeling. But other people that have listened to the discs and stuff of the dad think that he did it because he's a gun enthusiast. He's always talking about going to the shooting range and how he shoots these things in their head or whatever. And then he's posting stuff on Facebook, like, what's the best way to silence somebody? And it's a girl on her knees and somebody's got a gun to her head. And then the mom's posting stuff like, oh, how we've heard this before. We'll make it look like an accident, you know, and stuff. And then Dominique starts posting on Twitter and stuff. Her hair is so full because it's full of secrets. And then later she posted, well, happy Thanksgiving. I may not love you anymore, but I think about you often, and I hope you're enjoying turkeys on turkeys in heaven. And then she Twittered, I wonder if you heard what happened that night, and I should have just let you leave instead of trying to hold you back. And I found some of your stuff and it took me back to that. And it's like, wow. I mean, it just blows my mind.
So obviously this is all troubling stuff in your mind. And I want to point out for listeners, to be fair, they haven't been charged with any crimes in connection to this. This is, you know, opinions or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, you think there's enough here that merits an investigation, should have been done, that wasn't done. You know, just for somebody that might be listening and maybe thinks you're just a distraught mom who's, you know, upset about her son that died, and maybe you're just making something up in your mind to explain things, what would you say to them?
I would say no, because that wasn't even a thought. You know, all I was trying to do was find his cell phone. If she would have given me a cell phone, then there wouldn't have been any further, you know, but she kept changing her story and was lying to me. And I figured I wasn't going to get the truth from her. So I was going to try and figure it out myself. And I've asked many different people their opinions. I mean, you name it. If I'm researching and it says any questions or comments, please send an email. I send them my statement letter because we got together and figured that would be the easiest way to explain what I'm dealing with instead of, you know, trying to explain it all the time. And it's like attorneys, like, okay, let me back up to that AVO site, the AVVO.com. They all, after they told me their opinions or whatever, there was one attorney that reached out to me. He's like, would it be okay if I talked to you? And I said, yeah, you know, whatever. And he's like, okay, here's my number, or give me your number, I'll call you. So later on that night, he called me and he's like, no, let me start off with, I don't do that part of the law. He's like, I'm a civil attorney or whatever. He's like, but I, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a couple questions and then just give you my opinion. And I said, I'll take whatever I can get. So he was asking questions. I answered them. And then after we're done, he's like, okay, now let me remind you that this isn't my part of law. It's just my opinion. He's like, what it sounds like is there's a cover. He's like, you have a fight on your hands, but you have a huge fight because you're going up against his family and the sheriff's department, because friendship and money, you know, apparently is more important than a person's life. And he's like, but you have a fight. He's like, if you don't get anywhere on one level, you go above. If you don't get anywhere on that level, you go above. And you keep going and you keep going. He's like, it could be 1 year, it could be 10 years, it could be even 20 years. He's like, but when there's a rumor about the sheriff's department involved in a death and there's a crack in the pavement, with enough pressure, that crack's gonna break. And he's like, and you are your son's voice. He's like, so you have a long, hard fight on your hands, but you keep going to that top. You keep going until you get it taken care of. And he's like, but don't give up because you're your son's voice. So every time I start looking in something or whatever, I get responses to where it's just shut down. Like, for example, I kept trying to get the pictures of the bedroom and the 911 call, and I wasn't getting it. So I would make many trips down to Tucson, and I ended up going to the sheriff's department, and I said, I'm not leaving till somebody speaks to me. I sat there for 3.5 hours, and then finally somebody came down, and he's like, well, what can I do for you? And I said, I've got questions and nobody's responding to me. He's like, well, let's go up, you know, stairs and let's have a chat, you know? So I said, okay. So we go upstairs and he said, this is my name, Detective Flores, and I'm part of homicide. He's like, what can I help you with? And I said, well, this is what's going on. I said, nothing's making sense. I wanted to find my son's phone. And so I started telling him what's been going on, what my concerns are and what my issues are, whatnot. And he told me, okay, well, do you mind if I make copies of your stuff? And I said, no, I would like you to. And then, you know, let me know what's up. And he's like, okay, I'm going to look at this on my own time. So give me a little bit. I said, take as long as you need. And he's like, and I'll get back to you because this is bringing up my concerns. And I said, okay, cool. Well, then I guess he called the dad, was trying to find the phone. He called Dominique trying to find the phone. The dad's laughing on the recording saying, well, maybe it got folded up in his jeans when we threw out the bloody carpet in the landfill. Tell him to go look out there for it. Ha ha ha. And good luck. You know, and then her story, she's at school and the detective starts asking her, well, I'm just trying to help the mom find her son's phone. And she starts bawling hysterically. And he's like, you're not in trouble. I'm just simply trying to help her get the phone. And then the crying just stops immediately. And then she's right back to, well, I have no idea where it is. You know, this and that and the other. And then a week later, Detective Flores calls me and he leaves a message. He's like, okay, Jamie, I just wanted to keep you posted. He's like, I'm waiting on one more report. And then I'm going to take this to my boss on Monday and I'll let you know what my thoughts are. And I said, okay, great. Well, Monday, I never heard from him. A week later, never hear from him. I call him, left messages, no answer. And then it shut down and he ends up saying, well, there's nothing more. When I went back down to Tucson to stake it out again, he's like, well, I didn't really find anything, you know, to pursue. And that was the trend because like with the medical examiner, when he was asking me about the situation, as soon as he found out that the sheriff's department, and the family, our friends and they're involved, it shut down. All of a sudden he tells me that, well, when I was talking to the medical examiner, he said, okay, I will let you know what the findings are. I said, I wanted the bullet because it never exited. And he's like, okay, I'll be in contact with you. Well, then I get an email. The autopsy's done. If you have any questions, you know, contact this. And I was like, wait a minute. And then I called the medical examiners. I said, what about the bullet? And it was a lady that I spoke with. She's like, well, it's showing he didn't come in with anything. I said, yeah, Christopher said he was going to get the bullet because it never exited. And so she was going to have to look into that. But anytime I start talking about this to people, law or whatever, that would be able to do anything, they're interested. They get the same feeling I've got. They tell me, give me a week or so, let me look into it. And then it shut down. And that's it. That's where it ends. And that's been the ongoing situation.
It's been a real long and twisting road with a lot of letdowns and not getting any answers along the way.
Correct.
And I just want to look into your son's background. Was there any history of depression? Did he ever threaten to harm himself? Is there anything like that in his background that would ever point to him doing this to himself?
Well, when he was, okay, I raised him since I had him. And then I got with my daughter's dad, 7 years, there's 7 years difference. And we ended up with dealing with domestic violence with her dad. And we were on the run for about a year, moving hotel to hotel. And he did everything to me in front of my kids. I mean, my son, he was like in fifth grade and my daughter was kindergarten or something. And they witnessed it all. And my daughter would actually go up to people and say, my daddy gave my mommy a black eye. My name's Lizzie, you know, because preschool age, this is what's on her mind. And we dealt with that for about a year. And then he took off to Washington and that's where he's been. And my son had a lot of anger issues. And so I got him into counseling or whatnot. He was ADD, attention deficit, ADHD. We found out that he was that in second grade. And we got him on the medication. And then he slowly got better and got off of that. But then when he was in junior high towards high school, then he started becoming a man. And my dad owns his own company, garbage company. And so my son would go work for him during the summers. And then he just started progressing. And then he got two sisters pregnant and fell backwards. But it was like, it was a up and down, up and down. But he was the type that if there's somebody that was sad, he would make sure that they perked up. I mean, at the skate parks, he'd be skating with his friends and he would see a little kid struggling and he would stop what he's doing and go help that kid to learn how to skateboard. And when we were moving from hotel to hotel, he would find his broken skateboards and he would take them apart and build a new one and teach kids that were in the hotels how to skate. And he was the type of kid that would always give. He'd give you his shirt off his back if you needed it. I mean, he was always a giving, happy-go-lucky kid. And then he would take a dive, you know, to where he would take that shirt off your back and keep it, you know. I mean, he was a kid that was growing up trying to figure life out. And he ended up he dropped out of high school because it wasn't for him. So he went and got his GED. And then he started, like I said, selling clone out of the trunk of somebody else's car. You know, you pull up at a Circle K and these kids approach you trying to get you to buy clone. And then he went from that to working for CenturyLink or something. And then that's when he found out about the police academy. And so, because I kept telling him, I said, you know what, you got three babies now that depend on you. And I said, the two boys were 2 months apart and the little girl was a year behind. So they were two, she was one. And I said, you need to pull your head out of your butt and you need to do something because you need to support your kids. There's three babies depending on you. Oh yeah, mom, whatever. And I'm like, I'm serious. You need to do that. And so then he started like listening to me, I guess. And that's when he started doing good. But the way the whole thing went and the way things and the order, he wouldn't have done that anyways. And I know that he wasn't in the leaving mode because he would never leave the house without that stupid gun and his cell phone. Those were attached to his hip all the time. And the officer said that in the police report that his cell phone was plugged in to a charger in the bathroom. And one question that somebody else had asked, they said, okay, with this type of gun, it's a cheap, crappy holster that you have to take the whole thing off in order to get the gun out. It wasn't just a quick draw kind. And he's like, ask where the holster was. He's like, if the holster was near him, then I honestly don't think it would have been a suicide. It could have been an accident. Maybe he accidentally shot himself. But if the holster was nowhere near him, then there's no way. And that was one of the questions that I asked the sergeant, Cornitas. I said, can you tell me where the holster was? And he got back to me and he said, it's on a side table on the other side of the room. And I said, okay. And so that brought on more doubt. And then just the different changing of the stories. But yeah, there's no way he would have, not at that point in time in his life.
Well, after all this time, what are you hoping might still be done or can be done as far as you know? And where does the case stand now?
Well, right now, it's not. I mean, somebody had asked me once, what does justice mean for you? And I said, getting suicide removed off the death certificate. Because my son was not suicidal. He was a type, he couldn't walk past the mirror without stopping to look at himself. I mean, he loved himself. And there is no way. And I don't want his kids growing up thinking, you know, that their daddy killed himself. Because that's not what happened. That's not the case. And like I said, every time somebody's got interest in it, it gets shut down. And then that's it. And so my next mission, because they kept sending me pictures of the gun, the truck, I never got pictures of the actual bedroom where he was shot. And same with the 911 call. I kept getting discs of all the calls that the detectives made to people or people called in or whatever. I never got the actual 911 call until probably 3 or 4 years later. I got the actual 911 call of the night. Now, Danielle, who always called my son a son from another mother, she would get the pictures and discs and reports, and she would look over them before I would get them. Because I can't, after the third year, I couldn't even touch the binders. I couldn't look at it. Nothing. It was too much. And I still can't. I don't want to look at the pictures. I don't want to hear all that stuff. And so she does all that. And she'll let me know what she had found or whatnot. And with the actual 911 call, she said, oh my God, Jamie, you need to get over here. And I said, why? And she's like, you need to hear this. So she, now she's got 7 kids and her oldest son was best friends with my son. His name's Brandon. And she had her husband and whatnot. And she's like, I had everybody listen to this to see if they heard what I heard. And we all heard the same thing. And I said, okay, what? So me and my husband went over there and she's like, I'm just going to put it to this section. And Dominique's on the phone crying and bawling hysterically. The dad's saying, why does this have to happen in my house? You know, in the background. Well, then the mom gets on the phone and the dispatcher says, okay, now what happened? And she said, my daughter was in another room and she came up and she shot him. And then it paused. And as a few seconds, and the dispatch said, wait, what happened? And then the mom says, my daughter was in another room and she heard a big bang and she came up and he shot himself. And then a few seconds goes by and she's like, okay, one more time. And she said, she came up into the room because she heard a bang and he shot himself. Well, in the police report, there's nowhere that states that they were in separate rooms. Dominique stated that they were both in the room. They were drinking, which the toxicology report says there's no alcohol or drugs in their system. She said they were drinking. She got a text. My son saw it, flipped out, got the gun and killed himself. Not once does it mention that she was in a separate room or that, you know, they were separated from each other. In the police report, it states they were in the room. So it's like with the red flag of the mom saying she shot him. And then it was a pause, like, oops. And Danielle replayed it again and again. And you can hear it clear as day. It's like, why didn't they catch that? That should have been a red flag right there. But it was just dismissed. And then I requested the police report or the pictures of everything that had to do with my son. And so they just kept sending the same crap. Well, I was going to the ombudsman's because they're supposed to be for the public with records or whatever. And it was phone tag for a while. And I hate to do stuff over the phone. I prefer to see people face to face because I want to see their expression and whatnot. And so I did a lot of traveling and I would find where these people's offices are. Well, this guy, his name is Jerome. He is the person in charge of the ombudsman's. And he was on vacation. We're playing phone tag, yada, yada. And then about 3 weeks to a month later, I finally grabbed all my stuff and I went down there and I said, I'm Jamie. I'm the one justice for Zach. He's like, oh, yes. What can I do for you? And I said, what's going on? I said, there was never an investigation. So everything that has to do with my son's stuff, I should have, but I can't get the pictures of the bedroom. And he said, well, that's the problem. There's so many gray areas of the law that it would be almost like giving the pictures to the public. And the parents don't want the public knowing that there was a shooting in their house that resulted in a death. I said, but I'm not the public. That was my son. I need those. I said, I need everything that contains to my son. And that's the last piece of the puzzle. And I said, I'm not going to take it to the media. I'm not the media. I said, but I deserve to see those. And he's like, well, unfortunately, there's nothing I can do because, you know, the gray areas. And I said, you know what? Her parents don't want the public to know that there is a shooting that results in death. So I can't get pictures of where my son's life was taken. I said, I will tell you this. And I started gathering up my stuff. I said, when this is done, I said, everybody's going to know. I said, it's going to hit the fan and I'm going to make sure everybody knows what happened. He's like, well, I wouldn't recommend that. And I said, well, I don't care what you recommend. And I just walked out and that was the end of that. So then I was researching again and there was like different sites or whatnot. And I started hearing, like I went down to Tucson again because Detective Flores shut me down. And one of the discs of the calls that we received was actually the interview of when I first went there the first time and he took me upstairs. And I had no idea I was being recorded. He didn't say nothing of that sort. And what's crazy is he would ask me questions. And when he's talking, you can't even make out what he's saying because it sounds like some static, like he's rubbing his jacket or something, trying to get it to where he couldn't make out what he said. But you can make out most of what I was saying. And when I got another police report, because they sent me three different police reports that all had more information on each. And it states that he was one of the people that were part of it. In fact, he collected the bullet and took it to evidence. But when I had seen him the first time, he was telling me he knew nothing of my situation. But it shows in the third police report that he was the one taking the stuff to the evidence room. And so it's like, then I went to the attorney general's office and I filed complaints there. And the, but the attorney general ended up sending their chief of detectives up to my house from Tucson to Phoenix. And I was like, wow, okay, we're getting somewhere. And he came in with a couple ladies and they had a bunch of paperwork and I invited him in. I had Danielle there and another lady because I always like other people to be around. So I know what I'm hearing and that we agree or disagree. You know, we exchange notes pretty much to see if we're all understanding the same thing. Because I'm mentally a mess. I've been, and it's almost getting worse, it feels like. But I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because I could take what somebody else says and turn it into a whole thing, and then I forget half of what was talked about, and then I'm like, well, wait a minute, you know. And usually I write down everything. With this binder, it's every communication, every person I've sent my statement letter out to, everything. And so, so when the attorney general came, their chief of detectives, Keith St. John, came in, he started telling me that they sent the wrong part of the law enforcement, that they didn't know how to properly do a scene with the shooting. And, you know, it could have been an accident because he's like, well, how tall is your son? How, you know, tall is Dominique? And you think your Dominique could have overtaken your son? And I'm like, what are you here for? And he's like, well, I need to find out a little bit more about what, you know, you're finding out or what you're concerned or whatever. I said, where I'm at right now is I want the pictures of the bedroom where my son was shot. He's like, well, I can try and let me see what I can do. I might not be able to do much, but I'll try. And I was like, okay. And then these ladies were, I guess, for victim advocates, which this was probably about 6 or 8 months after my son was killed. And not one victim advocate reached out to me. But in the second or third police report I received, the victim's advocate reached out to her family and they didn't want any services. They were fine. But I never got a call from a victim's advocate. I was never approached, nothing. And they were bringing all these counseling pamphlets and stuff. And I said, you know what? I don't want to waste any more of your time. You're wasting mine. I think it's time for you to go. Because all you did is come up here to blow smoke up my butt and not. You're just trying to come up with excuses. And you drove 2.5 hours to tell me nothing. And so then they left. And then it turns out that there's a report. One lady found a report on Keith St. John that he was actually involved in a cover-up scheme, I guess, and hiding evidence or whatnot. So she printed out the report. I got that in my binder. And then a taxi or an Uber in Tucson. I had just left the sheriff's department and we were trying to get my son's truck because it broke down and it was taken to a tow yard. And an Uber, he's like, so how are you doing? I said, I'm a mess. And I just broke down. And he's like, what's going on if you don't mind me asking? And I'm a talker. So I started telling him, you know, little pieces in and out. And he's like, Sheriff Napier? And I said, yeah. And he's like, oh, my gosh. He's like, I just heard of a similar situation where it was like in Safford or something to where he had friends. And somebody was killed and he was covering for him and stuff. And I was like, are you kidding me? And he's like, no. In fact, I thought that's what you were talking about. But this is nothing to do with that. But it's almost familiar. He's like, I would recommend go talk to this attorney. He's a good attorney. He's awesome. He knows what the ins and outs are. And I was like, okay. So I was like, well, can you take me there? Because I've got plenty of time on my hands. I was waiting for a couple other things. And so he dropped me off. I go into this attorney's office and I said, I don't have an appointment. I just need to see if I can ask him a couple questions. So I gave the secretary, he was out of the office. I gave her my statement letter and I said, I was told that he could just answer a couple questions for me or let me know what the rules are or the state or whatever. And she's like, no problem. And then about 2 weeks later, I get an email. I'm sorry, I can't help with this. I'm not able to represent you and yada, yada, shut it down. And I responded, I wasn't asking for representation. I was told that you were a pretty good attorney, you know, the laws. And I was just wanting to know what my rights are, whatnot. And then he never responded. And that was it, shut down. And so that's
I guess in closing here, how hopeful are you that something else will be done, that the investigation will be reopened, reclassified, whatever you want to call it? How hopeful are you for something like that to happen?
I was very, very hopeful about a year ago. When I was doing my research and sending out my statement letter, there was a site saying no Napier or something. And it was a website to where deputies can file complaints and be unanimous and not keep their identity hidden, you know, so they don't get in trouble or whatnot. And so I just sent out my statement letter. Well, then, like, not even a few days later, I get an email from somebody and he said, "Hi, do you have a few minutes? I'd like to talk to you. I'm running for sheriff next year." And I said, "Oh, yeah, definitely." So we started going back and forth with emails and I sent him my statement letter. And he's like, "You know, I've been in office. I was the sheriff back in a couple of years ago, whatever. And I stepped down." He's like, "But I'm running for sheriff again." And I think this was, I want to say September, October. I have to go through my binder and look. But he said, "A lot of this doesn't sound right." And he's like, "And I want to make sure we get to the bottom line." He's like, "I know people that are in the homicide department." He's like, "I'm going to do some research myself, if that's okay." I said, "I'm willing." "Yeah, that's perfect." So I went down to Tucson. We made an appointment and I gave him a binder because we made 5 or 6 copies of the binder. And I left it with him. And I said, "You can take your time, go through it, you know, A to Z. If you have any questions," I made it to where a second grader could figure it out. And I have a binder at home with all the originals. So if there's any questions or issues, they can contact me and say, "Hey, I've got a question on, you know, section 3, tab 4, whatever." And I've got the same thing. And so he's like, "Yeah, give me some time." He's like, "Now I can't do anything until I'm in office. If I get to be the sheriff, it'll, you know, happen January. And then it'll take some time for me to get, you know, all whatever I have to get done. And then I can, you know, help you out." And I said, "No problem, you know." And then December goes by and January, he ends up becoming sheriff. So the following week, I sent him an email. I said, "Congratulations on becoming sheriff. Just let me know whenever you're available." And I said, "Do you remember me, Justice Brzezak?" And he immediately responded, "Of course I remember you. Give me about a couple weeks and then we'll sit down and have a meeting." And I said, "Great. Take as much time as you need. Just let me know." Well, then within a week, I went down there and I had my friend Danielle with me. And he just started kind of like, "I can understand, you know, your issues or whatnot." And he's like, "Things don't make sense. I'm going to try and figure out why they won't release the pictures of the bedroom and this and that and the other." And so then like a week later, he had the actual pictures of the bedroom. I said, "How come it was year 5. I said, "How come it took me 5 years and they wouldn't release it, but you got them in 1 week?" He's like, "Well, they like to try and protect you. You know, they don't want it to traumatize you any more than what you already have been." I said, "It wouldn't traumatize me anymore because, one, I don't look at them." I said, "I just wanted it because that's the last piece of this puzzle." And I said, "I want it all together to have it because that was my son's life." And I said, "So," and he's like, "Well, looking at the pictures, I really don't see anything. It just looks benign to me." And I said, "Well, that's fine. I just want him to put in his stuff." And he handed me the disc and I went on my way. Well, then there's another lady that's part of our POMC, Parents of Murdered Children group. And she's a retired sheriff from LA. Her son was murdered back in 98, I think, or something. And she came up to me and she's like, "Would you mind if I look through your binder?" I said, "No, have at it." And she contacted me and she's like, "Oh my God." She's like, "I can't believe this." She's like, "In LA, there is no way any of this would have happened this way. She's like, they would have sent out the medical examiner's office. This would have happened. This would have happened. This would have happened. She's like, the first thing they would have done is grabbed the cell phone. She's like, I'm going to make some calls and so forth. So she was looking at my stuff and she's like, you know, we got a huge cover up here. Well, then she wanted to sit. The new sheriff is Chris Nanos. And he's the one that was on board and got me the disc and whatnot. So she called him and wanted to set up an appointment with them because she had questions. And so he contacted me. He's like, is it okay if we had this meeting and I'd like you to come if that's all right? And I said, okay. So me and her name's Claudine, we went down to the sheriff's office with Nanos. And then he had brought in a new, chief of investigations. He was part of the meeting. And he's like, do you mind if he sits in? And I said, no, the more the merrier. And so I just sat back and let her ask questions, you know, because of her background. And she was like, okay, well, why do you guys do it this way? You know, and what about this? What about that? And then pretty much he was just backpedaling it, kind of coming up with excuses. Well, normally it's handled this way, but it wasn't, you know, they should have handled it this way instead. But that was it. And he's like, you know what? Your best bet is to go to the medical examiner's office because they can answer questions that I can't. And they're the ones that have the final determination on what's on the death certificate. And we're like, okay. Well, as we were getting ready to leave, their chief of investigations said, you know what? Here's my card. Do you mind if I make some calls? I've got questions too. And I said, no, go right ahead. You know, here's my name. Here's my number, you know, whatever. Just let me know what's going on. Whatever you find out, you know, if you have questions, you can call me or Claudine and, you know, we'll help. Well, then after that, we went to the medical examiners. So there's a new sheriff, a new chief of investigations, and there's a new medical examiner. Well, I couldn't go in the building because of the fact that knowing that my son was sliced up in there. I stayed outside and Claudine went in. We got there about 4:30 and they closed at 5. They didn't come out until almost 2 hours later. But when Claudine came out, a lady came out with her and she's like, Jamie, she wants to meet you. And I said, okay. And she shook my hand and she was the new head of the medical examiner's office. She's like, I can't believe what's going on here. She's like, I am so sorry you've been treated this way. She's like, that's absolutely absurd. And she's like, you know, when it's labeled a suicide or something, she's like, it's just in a file and we put it away. She's like, I had no idea about your situation. She's like, I promise you that I am going to get to the bottom line. I promise you. And I said, okay. She's like, you have been treated so bad. And she's like, you and your son both deserve respect. And neither one of you have gotten it. And I promise you, you are going to get that respect from me. And I said, cool. Because my whole thing is, why didn't the sheriff's department do the proper procedures when a call for a shooting came in? I'm like not even mad at the family anymore. I'm more mad at the sheriff's department because whether the friendship or the money, they still should have done the proper procedures of what they're supposed to do when they arrive for a shooting call. They're supposed to, you know, take pictures of the scene, test the gun residue. I mean, they're supposed to do all that. And because they were friends with the sheriff, they just took her word over it. And that's what they went with. And that's where I'm at. Because if the sheriff's department would have done their job the way they're supposed to, then the family wouldn't have been able to get away with things. And even if it's the same, I just want to know what the bottom line is. Did he accidentally shoot himself? Which I don't see how. And people that are in this profession said there's no way with the location of the bullet, but, or, you know, who killed him. But I want the bottom line. If they say the bottom line is he accidentally shot himself, fine. But I want somebody to investigate and ask questions instead of just taking her word over it. And so then we were like, okay, great. We were on our way back from Tucson and she's like, this is the best news ever. We got the right people in the right places to do the right things. Got a new sheriff, we got a new chief of investigations and a new medical examiner. So then, okay, a month goes by. And I was asking Claudia and I said, you think it's too soon to, you know, reach out to them? She's like, no, just ask them how things are doing. You know, just touch base with them. So I send an email out because I hate the phone. So I'd send emails or face-to-face is how I prefer. So I sent emails to the new chief of investigations and new medical examiner. It's not even a whole month yet, but I just said, hi, my name's Jamie Fly. I spoke with you. Do you remember me, Justice for Zach? And I was just touching base to see how things were moving along. I get an email within an hour from both of them. Well, we're not seeing anything, you know, to ring alarms or anything. So there's nothing more for us to investigate. But if anything new comes around, please let us know. And I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, the medical examiner said that looking at the pictures in the report, she's like, it's so sloppy. She's like, I can't make out a determination one way or the other. She's like, and with his cell phone, if it was a suicide, the phone is the first thing we would have grabbed. Because if it was a suicide, maybe he put a note in his phone, you know, a goodbye note or something. She's like, but why? I don't understand why we didn't go out there to investigate, because the sheriff's department said there was nothing to investigate and they shut it down. They said label suicide and that was it. She's like, we would have sent our team out there right away. We would have grabbed his phone first and then, you know, we would have done our research or whatever. And that's how it was when she was shaking my hand. But then not even a month later, I get an email back from her telling me that she couldn't find anything different and it's just going to remain as it is. But if I find new information later, let her know. Well, how can she have come up with that with less than a month when she was telling us that she couldn't make a determination because the reports were sloppy, the pictures didn't make sense. So what did she do within that month? You know, that's where I get so mad, because everybody, legal wise, non-legal, I tell them my concerns with the statement letter, for example. I send that out and it's not saying this person, that this and that and the other. It's saying what my concerns are and I can't get answers. I get shut down and I get told, oh, you better be careful. You're going to the sheriff's department. Something might happen. I said, bring it. I'm not scared. I'm looking for, you know, bring it. You already took the most important thing to me, which is my son. And it just pisses me off.
I can tell that it's very raw and it's still, even after all this time, it's still something that's a big part of you. And, I know the odds seem stacked against you, but I do hope that somehow you do get some answers and you're able to get somebody to take a fresh look at it and see what can be done.
Well, this, like, actually today, okay, last month, we have a support group in Tucson, Parents of Murdered Children. We have one in Phoenix and we have one in Tucson. And a retired homicide sheriff, or homicide detective, okay, retired homicide detective, just retired, and he was in either Minneapolis or Minnesota or something, and he moved down to Arizona, and he contacted the Tucson group, and he's like, I just retired, but I would like to offer my services. You know, I could volunteer my time for people that have cold cases or unsolved cases, or if people need help with court situations, I'd like to volunteer my time. And so they sent out a bulk email for all of the members, and I got it. And I was like, could you send him my statement letter and then just let him decide if this is something he'd want to look into? And she said, yeah, of course. So she sent him my statement letter, and then the next day he tried to reach out to me, and he's like, I got some questions. I didn't get to my phone. And he's like, can you give me a call sometime? And then we started playing phone tag and whatnot. So I got another binder from somebody else that was looking at it, just a member of our group, because they're all saying, you need to look at Jamie's binder because it's so organized and put together and yada, yada. And Claudine actually had told me that what I did is what they call a death book. And she's like, this is better than the way our department would put this together. She's like, you should consider that becoming, you know, part of law doing that. And I was like, no way. Nope. No. And so then I was like, okay. So one of the members is done with it. So she came back to me, and I asked, we had the National Day of Remembrance for Murder Victims in September. And I took my binder, and there are some people from Tucson that came up to it. And I said, would you mind taking this to that retired homicide detective, because he's inquiring about it, but I want him to look through from A to Z with my binder and then just give me his opinion. That's all I'm asking for. And she's like, yeah, no problem. So they just told me today that they actually delivered my binder to him. And I said, all I want, tell him to take his time. There's no rush. I mean, we're coming up on 7 years, which seems like yesterday. But I said, tell him to take his time, go through it. If he's got questions, he can contact me and I can answer them. I said, I just want his opinion. I want what he thinks is the bottom line. Does he feel like it was an accident and that's it? Or does he feel like we need to pursue this? That's all I want is his opinion. Because I'm like, once we left Tucson and we were so amped about, we had the right people in the right places to do the right things. And then it got shut down less than a month later when I reached out to them. It's like, now what? And Claudine's like, well, we have a huge fight. She's like, but he might, unfortunately, we might not get justice by human, but they'll get their justice by God. And with all this, I've lost my faith. I'm really mad about it. We used to go to church and everything before. Now it's just like, I'm so mad. And people are like, well, you should thank God. No, God, we're not supposed to bury our kids. Our kids are supposed to bury us. This isn't the way the plan goes. And so I lost my faith, but I'm like, no, I'm not accepting that. I'm not going to stop, because that one attorney at the very beginning that just wanted to give me his opinion stated, you're your son's voice. So all these years, whenever I felt like giving up and just, why am I doing this? That voice comes into my head. You're your son's voice, and you're the only one that's going to be able to get him his justice that he deserves.
We'll keep fighting for him, and I hope you do get that justice eventually. Thank you so much for coming on to share his story and your story.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you once again for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'd like to thank Sonny Landon for writing and research assistance in this episode. We'll be back here soon with an all-new episode of The Murder of My Family, and I hope you'll join me for it. But before you go, remember that every murder victim means something to somebody.